for listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up later in the program, employees in 9 cities filed sexual harassment complaints with the federal government against fast food giant McDonald's this week. We'll look at what impact that might have and take a closer look at the issue of harassment in the fast food and service industries.
First, it's time for our weekly review of Wisconsin news. State officials are weighing in on footage of a Milwaukee Bucks player being tased and arrested. This issue has garnered national attention. And also, an incident at a frac sand mine in western Wisconsin led to a spill of orange sludge into nearby rivers, and the state Supreme Court maintained a decision protecting Ho-Chunk burial mounds from excavation. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jay. Thanks.
So let's start with kind of the big news that was national. A couple of days ago, the Milwaukee Police Department released body cam video of Milwaukee Bucks player Sterling Brown being tased and arrested after a parking violation. We've gotten reactions to that footage now from the governor's office. What have we heard today?
Sure. Well, you know, somewhat interestingly, I guess, both Governor Scott Walker and Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish both issued statements here that were critical of the police officers who made the arrest. Of course, there are 3 police officers in all have been suspended so far. So there's a suggestion that there were some kind of rules broken in this case. But Clayfish said the video that was released was disconcerting and alarming. And a spokeswoman for Governor Walker followed up and said the governor agrees with those statements and then sort of pivoted to an argument in favor of police body cameras in general, saying that they provide documentation so a thorough investigation can be completed and individuals held accountable. It's not like a giant call for reform of police practices or whatever, but fairly pointedly, it's not a defense of the officers in this case either.
And so how do you think that this is playing in an election year?
Yeah, you never want to reduce everything to politics. It's so cynical, Jay, to reduce it to politics. But no, I mean, these are politicians. So, I think it's reasonable to read some sort of sense of the political impact in these statements that are coming from these particular politicians. And the truth is, this is national news. So there are a lot of eyes on this case and what the result is going to be. I think that part of what's maybe interesting is that it's coming at the exact same time as the new NFL policy, which is the policy bans players from kneeling during the national anthem. Why are the players kneeling? To protest unequal police practices. So it plays right into a couple of national debates.
Yeah, and because this is part of a national conversation, we talked about this yesterday on the show with former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist Eugene Kane. We also heard reaction from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, as well as the Milwaukee Police Chief. A lot of focus has been on Milwaukee, but how is this impacting people in, throughout Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think that there is, I guess that there probably is a tendency outside of Milwaukee to dismiss this as a Milwaukee problem, mm-hmm. or sort of slot this into a Milwaukee issue. There's a long history of that in Wisconsin, and I don't think that this is. I think this probably fits right into that pattern. Whether that is the truth, the reality or not, is sort of another question.
This wasn't the only big news throughout the state. If we look to western Wisconsin, focusing in on Trumbull County, on Monday there was a huge rescue operation at a frac sand mine, and that led to nearly 10 million gallons of this orange-colored sludge draining into nearby waterways. So what happened in that area?
Yeah, it's kind of a shocking story. So So first of all, yeah, the river is very orange right now. There are a lot of pictures circulating, and you can see for yourself. It is 10 million gallons. It turns out is a lot of sludge, and the effect just to the naked eye on the environment there is quite pronounced right now. So what happened was
Rob, you there? We are talking right now to Rob Mentzer. He is the statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. And we just covered some of the news about Sterling Brown, that body cam footage that came out this week, Sterling Brown being the Milwaukee Bucks player that was tased and arrested. And now we are talking about a frac sand pit spill in Trempealeau County. And as you were just saying, Rob, 10 million gallons of this sludge ended up in the waterways. Do we know how far the spill has reached so far?
Right. So it is on its way to a sort of a wildlife area there. But I mean, I have little technical difficulties. My apologies. But the what happened was, a bulldozer fell into this frac sand sort of settling pond that is part of these frac sand mines. The driver was trapped underwater for more than 2 hours and survived because the cab of this bulldozer is airtight. But I mean, that is a horrible thing to experience. So to their credit, first responders and workers at the mine saved his life. But to do it, they had to basically like open up this pond and then let all this gross water go out into the river.
Yeah, and we actually got a release today from the family saying that it was a terrifying experience and that they do not want to talk about it because there's been so much media scrutiny about what happened. And liquid from this pit, as we just talked about, spilled over into creeks and rivers after this person's rescue. And we heard from farmer Bill Silla, and this was his reaction to the spill reaching his own property.
I don't know what I'm going to do with that land now. It's covered in orange slime. What is it? What do you do with it? Is anything going to grow in it? I don't know. The whole field isn't covered, but the section that is, I don't know what to do with it.
You know, is there a lot of anxiety throughout this county now about what farmers can do with this land?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, so it's probably not too bad for the environment. I don't know. I'm not an expert, but that's what the...
So we are hearing about, these frac sand things and... moving on. So thank you, Rob, so much for joining us today. Rob Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us to talk about the decision but what happened in Milwaukee with Sterling Brown and the police releasing the body cam footage of his arrest in January. And we also talked about a sludge spill in Trempealeau County. Oil prices have been steadily climbing in recent months. Brent, which is the international benchmark for oil prices, had reached $80 a barrel for a brief time last week. That's the highest mark in 3.5 years.
Today, it fell to below $77, perhaps a sign that things are turning around, and U.S. crude finished below $69 after peaking at nearly $73 earlier this week.
As we roll into Memorial Day weekend, a gallon of regular gas will cost you nearly $3 across the state, but some places could even break the $3 mark.
So what's up with gas and oil prices these days? Well, Jim Ritterbush is here to explain. He's the president of Ritterbush & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm based in Galena, Illinois. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
So before we get too into the ups and downs, Jim, can you just tell us how the price of oil generally gets set?
The price of oil simply gets set by supply-demand forces, and in the past couple of years, on the supply side, OPEC has cooperated with Russia in limiting production by almost 2 million barrels a day, and that's helped force the price up. At the same time, Venezuela has seen a steady decline in their production, and that's forced a elimination of a huge supply surplus of about 260 million barrels of crude oil that just existed about 2.5 years ago.
I think a lot of us hear oil prices are going up. We might not think anything of it. We hear gas prices are going up, and all of a sudden alarm bells are going off. Are we talking about two very separate things here, or is it a safe assumption that when oil goes up, gas is right behind it?
Gas is right behind it. They correlate highly. So gasoline represents about half of the refined crude barrel, and when the feedstock, the crude oil, goes up, gasoline tends to correlate highly with that increase.
Recently, we've heard news that the U.S. has decided that they will pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. There are worries that Iran's exports may decline. How big of a player is Iran in terms of the global price of oil, and how much does that factor in here?
That's been a big factor ever since the Trump decision to renew sanctions. And Iran is a major player in the global oil market scene. And their supply was restricted for a number of years until the Obama administration took sanctions off. They cranked production up by more than 1 million barrels a day or so. And now it looks likely that we're liable to reverse those gains.
And sticking with the international theme, let's talk a little bit about Venezuela. You had mentioned that before, this is a country that's going through some economic turmoil, oil industry in a bit of a hurt. Give us a sense as to what's happening there and how important Venezuela is to the overall oil markets.
Well, Venezuela is a member of OPEC, and their production has been in decline for a few years as a result of the political turmoil in the country. So it looks like they could see a reduction in their production to around 1 million barrels a day here by the end of this year unless things turn around. And this was a output that was running at 2.5 or a million barrels a day or so. So it's declining, and there's no indication that that decline is even poised to level. But this is another reason why Saudi Arabia and Russia today indicated that they're willing to increase output and apparently in a effort to offset some of these expected lost barrels out of Iran, as well as the ongoing decline of output in Venezuela.
This feels like it would be the time where we start to hear increased calls for more domestic production. Is that something that people are talking about right now?
People are not only talking about it, but it's happening. We're seeing a dramatic upswing in shale oil production. It used to be where the increases would be coming out of North Dakota, but that dynamic has shifted down to the Permian Basin in Texas, where we're seeing the big increases now. The only problem with that is we don't have enough pipelines. We don't have enough takeaway capacity to get that crude out of there and into the Gulf Coast region. But bottom line is it looks like we're going to continue increasing U.S. production from around 10.7 to as much as 11 million barrels a day by this fall, which could make us the largest oil producer in the world.
Are we also, I mean, I know that we want to rely on our own oil here, but are we also exporting a lot of oil to other countries who also have that demand?
We're definitely seeing a huge upswing in the exports since the restrictions were lifted. So we're exporting as much as 2.4 million barrels a day compared to virtually very little exports, you know, in recent years. So that's become a very, very big item here as far as precluding any big dramatic supply increases in the U.S. As a matter of fact, we've virtually eliminated a supply surplus of crude in the United States, and we're just about at average supply levels at the present time.
We are talking right now with Jim Ritterbusch of Ritterbusch & Associates about where oil prices, gas prices might be headed this summer and beyond. And Jim, going back to OPEC for a second, we heard reports of OPEC and Russia considering boosting production for the first time since 2016, possibly by 1 million barrels a day. OPEC's next meeting is in about a month. Just generally, we touched on it a little bit, but I mean, what kind of impact would this have on prices, do you think?
Well, just the talk thereof has forced prices down by more than $3 a barrel here just a day. And backing up to Wednesday, we had the International Energy Agency of the United States indicating a surprisingly large increase in supply of almost 6 million barrels. In addition to that, we've had the U.S. dollar appreciating. So we've had a combo of items that have added or that that have been accompanied by an increase in the drilling rig count just today of 15 units. So these four items alone have dropped the futures price of gasoline by more than 11 cents in just 3 days. So that's a good news. Bad news is it takes a while. You have a time lag before that translates down to the retailer pump level. But at the end of the day, it doesn't look like these $3 average gasoline prices are going to go much higher.
I want to talk more about why some of the production gets cut back in the first place. If we're even talking about someone boosting oil production by a million barrels, it means that that was cut back at some point. And I know you said that so much of this industry is driven by supply and demand, but it seems like there's always demand for gasoline here in the United States. I'm wondering, going back a little bit, what accounted for some of these cutbacks in production in the first place?
Well, this goes back more than 2 years, almost 2.5 years, when we had a huge excess of supply. So if you back up to 2.5 years, we were looking at crude prices down around $30 a barrel or less, compared to around $68 today. So at that price, we're seeing U.S. Production that was simply running at the less than the cost to produce it. So OPEC, in the meantime, was losing money, even in some of the more wealthy countries, and they, for the first time, managed to engineer a pact with Russia to curtail production by 1.8 million barrels a day. And they did a good job, but surprised me, but they eliminated a huge supply surplus to the point where now supplies are just about average. So now they're flipping and they're saying, okay, we've accomplished our objectives, so we're going to loosen things up. And some of that, I think, is politically charged. I think when Trump slapped sanctions back on Iran, they did Saudi Arabia a favor, and now Saudi Arabia is looking to return that favor by increasing production and pushing prices a bit lower.
So if that wasn't enough to keep track of, there's something happening kind of on the horizon that we wanted to get your take on. A story in CNBC on their website caught our eye. Some analysts are warning that new emission standards on ships, we're talking about huge ocean liners, these are expected to kick in around 2020, may cause crude oil prices to soar. Morgan Stanley says Brent may climb up to $90 a barrel. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, some of the banks are already saying crude could go to $100 by the end of this year, and I just don't see that that happening. As far as looking down the road a couple of years, a lot of things could change, and some of these standards, as far as shipping is concerned, I think at the present time are being a bit overplayed. But that factor is one that probably won't achieve any clarity until sometime next year. And in the meantime, there's a lot of factors that could develop that could completely offset that. So from my perspective, I'm not viewing that as a critical item at the present time.
Let's bring it back to the United States for a second. We're seeing a lot of big cars being sold on the road. We got an announcement recently that Ford was going to be phasing out some of their smaller, maybe more fuel-efficient cars in favor of trucks, in favor of SUVs, which apparently American consumers are in the market for again. Are there going to be a lot of consumer regrets a couple years down the road if crude oil prices keep ticking up like this?
Sometimes. sometimes when you see things like that begin to evolve, it's a pretty good sign that prices are approaching a top. So I think that the buyers of the SUVs and things are probably going to receive some satisfaction. I don't think they're going to feel sorry for the decision, at least when you're talking about the cost of gasoline or diesel. But yes, there's been a huge swing that way. I think some of the car makers have even stopped producing sedans for the time being. Everybody wants a truck or an SUV, and I see that trend being sustained, if I'm correct in assuming that we pretty much hit our lid here of around $3 in regular gasoline on average.
And that's a good place to leave it. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Have a nice weekend.
You as well. Jim Ritterbusch is the president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm based in Galena, Illinois, and we talked about where oil and gas prices might be going this summer. The nation's largest fast food chain is under fire this week after 10 employees in 9 cities filed sexual harassment complaints with the federal government against McDonald's and its franchisees.
The workers, all women, each say they reported the harassment, but managers ignored their complaints or even retaliated against them. Now backed by 2 advocacy groups, they're taking their case to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Regardless of what happens next, the case is shining some light on the experience of fast food workers across the country, many of whom say they have experienced harassment at work. A 2016 survey of women who worked in non-managerial positions in fast food found that 40% had experienced unwanted sexual behavior at work.
Shireen Alamzada joins us now. She is a Chicago attorney and the co-founder of Healing to Action, which describes itself as a worker-led movement to end gender-based violence. She also co-founded the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. Shireen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So since the beginning of the Me Too movement, many industries have come under the microscope on the issue of sexual harassment. Some really big cases, they started in Hollywood and it spread from there. But do you think that the fast food industry tends to get overlooked in the broader conversation about sexual harassment?
Well, I think it's telling that there was a survey that was done by Fight for 15 a couple of years ago, really highlighting this problem, and you know, that there wasn't the same level of media attention around the experiences of fast food workers in McDonald's at that time. Certainly, I think the Me Too movement has provided an opportunity for workers from many different industries to come forward and share their stories, and so I'm heartened to see the momentum that is building in this movement of fast food workers to share their stories and to seek justice, you know, in the face of all of the media attention that has been focused for the most part at this time on Hollywood and some higher earning industries.
And so that brings us to this week when 10 current and former McDonald's employees, again, all women, filed sexual harassment complaints against the company. You know, we have these women. What kind of allegations are we seeing here?
So I think many of the allegations had to do with supervisory harassment, so experiencing unwanted comments, groping, touching from people who had power over fast food workers in these restaurants. There was also, I believe, allegations of retaliation as well as not taking action when it was reported to other levels of management. And just to sort of give a little bit of a, you know, to give a little bit of a landscape here of what we're talking about, these are workers who are earning very little money, close to minimum wage, sometimes just minimum wage. And so if McDonald's is their primary form of income, their primary source of income, they're likely to be living at or below the poverty line. So these are poverty level wages. So people in these jobs have very little security in actually coming forward and reporting any sort of harassment. They also have very limited resources to seek legal recourse if they want to pursue a claim against one of the most powerful corporations in the world with an extremely sophisticated legal apparatus behind it. So the fact that these workers are coming forward and reporting this, and the fact that, in fact, some recent studies have shown that food service workers are they make up a very large percentage of complaints that are filed at the EEOC, all go to show the scope and scale of this problem given that these are people who really, you know, have no reason to report, and yet they're still coming forward in large numbers.
Well, and it sounds like it could be a really tenuous situation for them, as you mentioned, given that this might be their only form of income. They're not earning that much. So this job is really, it's important. And, you know, many people might not be stepping up to say, hey, this has been happening. So are we seeing that, you know, given that this lawsuit has been, you know, or that the complaints came up this week, they came up in the past. But are we seeing that, or are you anticipating that we could see many more of these complaints come out now that these 10 women have stepped forward?
Yes, I think that is definitely the case. As you know, as I think was mentioned before, there were some charges that were filed a couple of years ago, and I believe it's fairly unclear what McDonald's has done in response to those complaints. I believe some of them are still pending at the Equal Employment Commission. But what's different with this group of workers is that there has been a very coordinated legal effort, in part because of the Me Too movement and the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, which launched earlier this year. These workers are actually connected with attorneys who are pursuing their claims. And I think it's important to note that while fast food workers and other low-wage workers make up a large percentage of complaints that are filed at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, because of how expensive and harrowing and time-consuming the litigation process can be, most of those complaints never make it to court or to any sort of really favorable resolution for the workers. And so the fact that now there are attorneys that are not just representing these workers, but are that are coordinating legal strategy and working in collaboration with other activist groups like Fight for 15, I think shows the potential for a much more sort of vigorous, you know, approach and response to this problem at a national level.
We're talking to Shireen Alamzada right now. She is a Chicago-based attorney and the co-founder of Healing to Action, which is it describes itself as a worker-led movement to end gender-based violence. And she's also the co-founder of the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. And we're talking about lawsuits brought forward by 10 McDonald's employees who say that they were sexually harassed on the job. So what's at stake here with these complaints for McDonald's?
So my understanding of McDonald's immediate response to the complaints is that they're arguing that they don't have responsibility for the hiring practices or labor practices of their franchisees, so the restaurants that are franchised. So most of these complaints are alleged both against the corporation, the McDonald's corporation, as well as these independent franchisees. So that is their immediate, I think, response, and that is typically the response they have given when they have been, confronted.
And what consequences could the company potentially face if, you know, the EEOC says you need to change your ways?
Well, with individual lawsuits, they could face, the possibility of having to pay monetary damages. There could also be, efforts made in the complaints for McDonald's to change certain practices. I know that the Fight for 15 is asking specifically for training, for mandatory training for the restaurants. And I believe there might be a couple of other demands. So it's possible that there will be some policy changes. Now, I just want to be clear that McDonald's, again, it's a very sophisticated corporation. It has a huge legal apparatus behind it. It has policies, and so I think it's important to remember that while these lawsuits might result in, you know, new policies or, some level of trying to sort of reform existing practices, that it's not enough to have a great policy or to have compliance training. That this really comes down to an issue of culture and of how workers are being valued in the workplace. And if you have a restaurant culture where people are being paid very little, where there's a lot of labor violations happening, regardless of how great you have, what type of great written policy that you have, you may not see much change in the way of the level of abuse or harassment that people are experiencing. So it's important to recognize that and to try to make sure that we're holding all businesses accountable, but particularly very powerful and well-resourced businesses like McDonald's, to shifting that culture and making sure that workers are experiencing a dignified and safe workplace every day.
We're talking right now with Shireen Alamzada. She is the co-founder of Healing to Action and the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. And we're talking about sexual harassment in the fast food industry. This week, 10 employees in 9 cities filed sexual harassment complaints with the federal government against McDonald's and its franchisees. And we're looking at the impact that might have in low-wage workplaces across the country.
You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Are we telling your story here today? Have you experienced harassment in a low-wage job such as fast food? What do you think can be done to crack down on harassment in this kind of work? And what questions do you have? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after the short break.
We're continuing our conversation with Shireen Alamzada, co-founder of Healing to Action and the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. We're looking at sexual harassment complaints filed with the federal government this week against McDonald's and its franchisees, as well as the broader issue of harassment in low-wage work, such as fast food.
You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced harassment in a service or a retail job? If so, did you report it, and what ended up happening? What do you think can be done to better protect employees in low-wage jobs? And, you know, what questions do you have? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Shireen, right before we went to the break, we were talking about a change in culture that needs to happen in these lower-wage workplaces. And I know you've written about this in the past, where this is usually the first job that many people have. So how important do you think it is to demonstrate good workplace behavior early on?
I think it's critically important. It's true that, a good portion, a large percentage of the low-wage workforce is young people. And the way that a lot of people come into the workforce is through that, fast food job, working in a restaurant, doing retail. And it does happen that these industries do have extremely high rates of sexual harassment. And so if that's the first time that you're in the workplace, remembering as well that younger workers are vulnerable in a variety of ways. They may not, this may be their, they have certain attitudes towards authority. They may feel that if they report harassment, they would get in trouble just based on other experiences they're having as young people. All of these types of patterns or behaviors in the low-wage workplace are going to shape and condition how people experience sexual harassment as they move through different sectors of the workforce. So if you feel like it's something that happened and was normal in your first job, you may be less likely to react to it, report it, call it out in your next job. If you're somebody that did it in your first job and nothing happened, again, it's creating this expectation of impunity that then follows people through their careers as they start to gain power. So I think it's a really important intervention point in our society for helping people understand, what is appropriate and respectful behavior, what is a safe workplace, what is it supposed to look like, and really trying to normalize that both for young people and for anyone who's working in that job.
And it sounds like there is a ripple effect when this does happen, both for the people being harassed and the people committing the harassment. But let's look at some of what recourses that some of these low-wage employees might have in these kinds of situations.
Yeah, so I mean, there's all kinds of laws that prohibit sexual harassment in the workplace. Obviously, there's the federal law, Title VII. Which is enforced through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is what we saw in this case. There's also a variety of state and local laws and ordinances that also provide additional protection, sometimes even broader protections for low-wage workers against sexual harassment. It's also a workplace health and safety issue, so there's, occupational safety and health laws that can be used. And then finally, I think one of the most important mechanisms that people have, which returns to the issue of McDonald's and the fight for 15, is union organizing and collective action in these situations where, for example, unionized workers could work additional protections into a collective bargaining agreement with a large employer. Now, the issue is that McDonald's workers are not unionized, and so that is one of the main vulnerabilities that they face, is that a lot of times they do have to go and make these complaints by themselves. And again, thinking about what that means as somebody who is living paycheck to paycheck, is struggling to pay rent, to try to, you know, bring a lawsuit against one of the most powerful corporations in the world, and potentially do so without an attorney, or even if they have an attorney, it's not going to be always the case that attorney is going to have the resources that match. I mean, it's probably very rarely going to be the case that attorney has the resources to match McDonald's. So thinking about how collective action and unionization are so important when we're talking about such a vulnerable workforce and such large companies.
So this lawsuit is being brought to the EEOC. That's a federal agency. As an attorney, what kind of game plan is there by going this route?
Well, the way that the process works, to my understanding, these were individual complaints. So the EEOC is the law enforcement agency that investigates charges of discrimination. And so the first step in the process is that the agency will investigate the claims and decide whether or not to make a finding of discrimination. This is the first step for most, for any employee who wants to bring a lawsuit. You have to go to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission first. And then some people will then file a lawsuit in federal court, alleging the misconduct that was brought in the original charge. But it's going to the federal court, which would actually then entitle the worker to have their case heard, potentially to obtain money damages and other forms of relief. So the charge filing is really just the first step, and there's a lot more that happens. A lot of times these cases take several years to work their way through the federal court system, and sometimes the parties will settle at some point, sometimes early in the process, sometimes later on, and reach an agreement that doesn't require litigation at all.
Shireen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action and the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. She joined us to talk about sexual harassment complaints filed with the federal government this week against McDonald's and its franchisees, as well as the broader issue of harassment in low-wage jobs.
This year, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking Wisconsinites what's on their mind this election season, and we're meeting them where they are, out in the community.
After 17 people were killed at a high school in Parkland, Florida in February, many young people started talking about guns as a political issue. In Madison, 3,000 students left class and walked to the Capitol advocating for tougher gun laws.
Madison East junior Carson Tominey sat down with his government teacher Nick Adams to talk about this issue and more.
All right, Carson, so okay. You're going to be too young to vote this fall, but if you could vote, would you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why?
Yeah, I will not turn 18 until this December, so I'll be too young. But if I could, I'd definitely exercise my privilege to vote. Mr. Adams, are you going to vote this fall, and why?
Yeah, I will. I haven't missed an election since I was able to start voting in 2000. That was my first election. That's the easiest opportunity for me to have a voice. By me voting, I'm also setting an example, not only for my students, but for my children who like to go vote with me.
Absolutely.
So as we come up into the November election, what is the single most important issue to you?
There's definitely a lot of important issues to me, but if I had to single out one of them, I'd say maybe the most controversial issue as of late would be gun control. And you see, you know, school shooting after school shooting. And at this point, to me, it's not about, politicians sending thoughts and prayers to families, but rather, making actual changes to, you know, stricten up gun control laws and, you know, take action before more people die.
It's interesting hearing you say that that's like your number one issue. It's been more persistent since Stoneman Douglas. The fact that it's had this lasting of an impact surprises me. Mostly because, no offense to teenagers, but they're so focused on the now. And that was then, you know, even though it was only, 3 months ago, I'm surprised that to learn that this is still a sizable issue and that maybe will have some longevity. If it can last a summer, I think it can be still an issue in November, but I'll say I'm pessimistic that it will last the summer.
What do you hope that students get out of your government class this year?
What I'm hoping, I'm hoping you get out of this too, and we only have a month left, but my hope is that you know how to vote and that you know the barriers that you have to overcome to vote, like registering, making sure you have the right ID, that type of stuff, and where to go vote. I'm hoping that my students understand how they can participate in the elections. You know, come fall, I'll have them do a lot of research on the issues. What are the candidates' stances on the issues so they can walk away with knowledge from both sides? One of the things I've noticed in this school, this community, is it's very left-leaning. Make sure they expose them to the right, to the conservative sides of the issues, because maybe they only hear what they hear in their little echo chambers, right? Like Facebook, you're not hearing the conservative side of it. So I need to make sure that we balance, I balance the issues so that if they can vote in November, they can make informed decisions. And they're not just voting a certain way because somebody told them to do so. You know, I want them to do it because they want to do so.
That was Madison East Jr. Carson Tominey and his government teacher, Nick Adams. For more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/ballot, or to share your story, call our hotline at 877-782-8942.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk with the author of a book that profiles each of Wisconsin's 37 servicemen who were missing in action in the Vietnam War.
Today is the deadline for Democratic candidates for governor to file their papers in order to get a speaking spot at the party's upcoming convention. We'll take a look at who made the cut.
All that and much more coming up on Central Time on Monday.